Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to another in our series of Voices from the Archives of the Mark Steiner Show. The first time I heard Jean Ritchie was in 1961 with some other civil rights workers who had her first album she made in the 1950s. The first time I heard Doc Watson was in 1963 with Arlo Guthrie up in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. In 1964, I saw them play at the Newport Folk Festival. I've been hooked ever since. We'll be talking to the grandmother of folk music, the woman who introduced dulcimers to us all, Jean Ritchie, and the grandfather of modern folk music, the great bluegrass artist Doc Watson. Then you'll hear our conversation, a short piece of it, with Ted Joyer, a noted musician and award-winning author, about his book, Delta Blues, the life and times of the Mississippi masters who revolutionized American music. So join us for a look into the history of our American music, folk, bluegrass, and the blues. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. You've just heard Jean Ritchie playing the song Over the River Charlie, recorded live some 35 years ago in New York City, of all places. She was playing at a small club called Gertie's Folk City with Doc Watson, a musician from North Carolina she'd just recently been introduced to. They've gone on to individually become world-renowned folk musicians. And now, both at the age 84, it's hard not to think of them as living legends, though they probably are too humble to admit it, and hate being thought of like that. In just a minute, Jean will be joining us by phone from her home in Kentucky, and later this hour, Doc's going to be joining us for the conversation from his home in North Carolina. First, let's listen to another song from that same concert. It's an old ballad called The House Carpenter, and on this version, Doc plays the banjo while Jean sings. Hi, Jean Ritchie. This is Mark Steiner. How are you?
I'm sitting here on my porch in Kentucky and looking at the mountains. It's a beautiful morning.
Where should we start here? So many places to start. I was thinking about how you and Doc Watson are going to be here together in that concert you did in '63 that became that album.
Yes.
Have you played together since then?
Let's see. Have we? I don't believe so.
That's amazing.
No, I don't think so. I went to one of the Folklife festivals in Washington, and we were walking around, and he was singing, and he found out that I was there, so he asked me to come up, and we did a song together, things like that, but we haven't done a planned program together at all. At Newport, we did a couple of things at Newport together, too. I guess that was, the 64 when you was there.
Right, I remember that. I was there. I saw you there. I was in the audience back then as a kid.
Uh-huh. And then you grew up.
And then I grew up. I remember that really well. So I think that there's so many things that you've done for us. I mean, I think about the dulcimer. My sister plays the dulcimer, and we were talking about the other night that I told her I was going to be talking with you, and she lives in the hills too. She lives in a holler in West Virginia. She's been there for 35 years. Won't come out. And she's a photographer and works against mountaintop removal down in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And she was just, we were talking about it. Walt and I were talking about the same thing about, in many ways, you introduced the dulcimer to America outside of its region. I mean, you helped explode that sound.
Yes, yes. It took me several years to talk people into playing it because I didn't realize how easy it was to play. And I said, but it's very easy. You know, come backstage and in 5 minutes I can tell you all I know about it. So they'd come and they'd say, oh, it sounds so beautiful. Oh, you could. No, I could never play it. I said, yes, you can. And things like that went on and on. And finally, somebody, I guess, discovered that it was really an easy instrument to play and sounded good no matter what you did. So they started playing it. And but it did take me years to sell that idea for everybody playing it.
What was that story about how you first picked up your father's dulcimer, and even though nobody pick it up, but you did?
Oh, you know how, you mean how I learned to play?
Yeah.
Well, I was a little child, too young to go to the cornfield, and my father and all the others, the girls and the boys, would go away to the cornfield early and at the break of day, and I'd stay home with Mom, and we'd get dinner for them. And I'd run the little errands that she wanted me to do, but there was a lot of free time, so I'd go in the, I got a yen to play the dulcimer, and I kept asking my dad to let me have it. No, you're too little, you'll break it. And when you get to be 6 or 7, I'll show you how to play. I'll let you hold it. So he'd go off to the cornfield, and when Mom wasn't looking, I'd go in and get the dulcimer down real carefully and take it behind the noter. You know, had to have a noter to play it, and in those days, we thought we did anyway. And I'd go back in the back and back behind the Davenport, and they set them catty-cornered in the room, you know, to make the room look modern. And there was a little nice little hole back in there, a little triangle that you could go and sit in. So I'd pull it out a little bit, get in behind there with the dulcimer and sit down and just play and play. And pick the strings. And one day I picked out a tune, Aunt Rhody, Go Tell Aunt Rhody. And I got all excited and I got started playing on that. And little by little, I learned how to do different things with Aunt Rhody, and then I learned how to retune for it, to change the strings and make it play Going to Boston, which had a note in it that wouldn't play in the key that my father had it tuned to. He had it tuned to bim, bim, bom, which is a major key, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he played everything there. He didn't know how to play in any other mode. But when I tuned it, the first string a little differently, it would play that note in there. Won't we look pretty in the ballroom? Won't we look pretty in the ballroom? That note, won't we look pretty? That wasn't there on the other tune. So I got all excited. I'd learned something that I could do where I could play the tune, and that my father never had been able to play because of that note not being there.
Mm-hmm.
And so little by little I learned. I guess the dulcimer taught me a lot about music, because I didn't study, but I learned all those things, you know. That, and then my father would come in at night and say, Abby, the weather's got in these strings again.
And how old were you then?
I was about maybe 5.
That's amazing. Yeah. So, now, when did your dad finally figure out that you were sneaking back in the corner playing his dulcimer?
I imagine he found out long before I thought he did. But when I was about 6 and I see if he said one day, all right, Gene, come on, I'm going to let you hold the dulcimer. And he put it in my lap and said, now do this and do it. Put your hand here with an odor and put your hand and strum the strings. And he gave me a little pick, you know, to pick it with if I wanted to. So I started playing and I started picking out Aunt Rhody. And he said to my mother, now, Abby, listen to that. We've got us a musician on our hands.
That's great.
And I never did study music, and I tried to a couple of times, but it didn't seem to work with my songs.
Uh-huh.
And the other story I sometimes tell is coming home from college where I was trying my best to learn music theory and how to read and write music, and I studied for one semester, one quarter, I guess it was then. And came in, and I was taking voice lessons. And so I came in, and I was singing, trying to sing in my new voice, one of the old ballads, Barbara Ellen, I guess it was. And I was singing, oh, mommy, mommy, around that. And my father said to my mother, is that child sick? Well, I heard him say that, and it really hit home to me, and I thought, well, I better not do that I better not try to sing that song in what I'm learning. And then I said, well, why am I learning this? Because if I learn it, I'll change all my music, and it won't be right. The songs won't sound the same, and it's not fair to the songs to sing them in this kind of way. So I went back to sing them like I learned them from Granny and from the old people.
Oh, when I was a curly-headed baby, my daddy set me down upon his knee. Said, son, you go to school, learn your letters. Don't you be no dusty manner. Like me, for I was born and raised at the mouth of the Hudson Holler. Coal cars roaring and rumbling past my door. Now they're standing rusty, old, empty. And the element don't stop here anymore.
One of the things the stories that I've been reading about you is that when you, you grew up in this large family in rural Kentucky, with a family not out making money but growing food and taking care of itself in the hills, and you ended up in New York City as a social worker. That piece of your life to me is just fascinating, that you went from Kentucky to New York and then the work you did with the dulcimer and the housing projects. That must have been a really kind of eye-opening thing for you, walking into New York as a young woman out of Kentucky.
Oh, it was. When you went to college, you know, you had to, and I wanted to go to college. It was one thing our father sold us on when we were little. He said, you have to all go to college, all go to school, get some learning, because that's, you know, that's what you need in this world. You need to know what's going on. And he was one of the first people around in our neighborhood to feel that way, because most everybody felt, well, the boys can go to school through the whatever school they want to, but the girls, when they get to be 16, 17, they were expected to marry and settle down and raise a family and look after the house and all that, but they just weren't expected to be educated. But my father expected every one of us to go to school.
That's great.
and got us out there. They had no money to give us, but they said, you can have the time. You can have time away from home and working with us and in the fields and in the house, and you can go off and get some learning. So they would let us go. And that was what the gift they gave us was the time. And we had to make our own way.
And I'm just always curious, when I read about your life, what it was like when you first hit New York City for you, what that feeling was like from a girl from a young woman from the hills who had gone to college in Kentucky. I mean, a little, and then
well, it happened in a roundabout way. I was trying to figure out what to do and what to study and what to major in, and I wanted to. In the early days, I think most young people have a religious phase and they want to be missionaries and things like that. And I wanted to be a missionary first, and I got thinking, well, do I want to make people listen to what my religion is and when maybe their religion is different? And I got thinking about that, and I said, no, I'll just learn how to, I'll study something that will let me help people in all ways, and whatever religion they want, they can have. And so even as a young person, I felt that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I studied social work. I discovered social work and went to, when I transferred from my junior college to UK, University of Kentucky in Lexington, there was a man sitting behind a little sign that said social work, and I thought, that's it. So I went, he looked very lonesome. I went over there and I said, I'd like to sign up for social work. And he just said, thank God someone's come. And this was the first year that they had any, they were offering any social work at all. And it was just a social work department within another, I think it was Inwood English or something like that. And so I signed up for that. And I was the first one and the first graduate that they had in social work. Now they have a whole college of social work on
wow.
campus, and they have so many students. And when I go back, I can't believe that I started this whole thing out.
That's great. I love that. That's beautiful. And when you went to New York, I
went to New York, and he knew this. My advisor and teacher knew someone at the Henry Street Settlement. So he sent me to summer camp. He said, go to summer camp and see how you like that area. And in the winter, maybe they'll ask you to stay for the winter program and you can see the city and so on. And so I did. I went to the Lower East Side and had a little room in the Henry Street Settlement, kind of dormitory they had up in top floors. First, we went to the summer camp, and it followed through that they did want me to stay through the winter because they were... they were all enchanted with the Southern music, you know, the Appalachian music, the mm-hmm. ballads and songs, and the fact that I knew the real ones, you know, not just marketed ones, but mm-hmm. I knew the real ones. And so they had me stay for the winter and have a group and work in the evening with the teenagers and in the afternoon with the young kids and so on. And everybody said, didn't it scare you to be in New York? Well, it did in a way. I'd go out and go uptown and look all around and just be flabbergasted with the Times Square and all that and the lights in the evening and think, if my mother knew where I was, she'd make me come right home. You know? So I sort of self-peddled it all when I went home. But because I didn't want them to take me away until I learned what I wanted to learn up there. And my mother finally came to visit me, and she saw what a big place I was in. I said, Mom, it's just like a bunch of small towns all put together. It's not, it's just, you know, don't worry about it being a big city, because that's what I felt like. And it's true, you could go to one section, and they'd all be speaking Italian. You'd go to another section, they'd all be speaking Yiddish. And so, you know, it was just like a bunch of small towns. And I think it still is. I still think of New York City that way.
That's a great way to think of it. I've never thought about that, but it's true. Now, when you were there in the late 40s, early 50s, that's where you met people like Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie and Lead Belly and sang with Oscar Brand and on the NYC and the radio.
Yes, that was it. See, I don't know exactly who found out that I knew old ballads, but I remember being on one program one night where there was a lot of other people on the same program, and Woody was there, and he had sung before me, and then I came on, and I did a ballad with the dulcimer, and he came up afterwards and said, you know, you get more music out of them three strings than I get out of 12. And he was kind of flirting with me. You know, he always did that.
We heard he was a big flirt, right?
All the girls. So, but we got to know each other and met occasionally at festivals like that. And he was, when I did my first big solo concert, Alan Lomax had me do a concert at Macmillan Theater at Columbia. And I went up and at first I did the one where there were several other people on it. Texas Gladden was there and Vera Hall and a lot of other people playing different music. I think Andrew Rowan Summers was there with his dulcimer. And there was a big hammer dulcimer player from the west, northwest. And that was where you could hear them then. You could hear hammer dulcimers in the northwest and also in some parts of West Virginia had a hammer dulcimer or two. And so that was where the hammer dulcimer was first played in New York, too, that night. And we all had a great time, and we were in the back room. And I was talking to Texas, and she was trying to get me to come and visit her and was in Virginia because she had a younger son, had a son that she wanted me to meet. She said, "I got a boy that would just love to meet you." She said, "He loves red hair." So I said, "Well, I'll have to come and see you sometime." I was kind of kidding around with it. And all of a sudden, this is the first time I ever saw Woody. He came jumping into the room, actually jumping. He had a guitar on over his back in a case, and he was jumping around the room, sort of leaping around the room. And there are all kinds of microphones sitting there, just waiting to be used. You know, sort of stored in there. And he would leap from microphone to microphone and go 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, checking. You know, and then he would blow into the microphones, and I thought, well, what in the world is that madman doing, you know? And finally, he jumped around and said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm Gene Ritchie." And he said, "I'm Woody Guthrie." I didn't even know who Woody Guthrie was. And so we got off to that kind of start. We were kind of kidding each other and laughing. And I said, "Why are you acting so crazy?" He just said, "Oh, I just, that's the way I am."
Well, those are great memories.
Yeah.
They really are.
And all the others, I met the others too in similar ways. I met, Hallie Wood and Pete Seeger. I met Pete Seeger at the Henry Street Settlement when he came down to do a program. And, we've been friends ever since. Pete and Toshi were there that night.
You stay in touch with Pete Seeger? You stay in touch with Pete Seeger?
Yes, we do. He's in. The last time I actually was with him was when we did the Kentucky. No, that's not the last time, but that was one of the last times. The KET did a program, a show about me, what do you call it, a video, a DVD.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A documentary?
A documentary, yeah. I was looking for that word. And we went up to visit Pete. He said we could come, and he would be on it, and he would talk about me. So he's on there, and we went up to his house and told she made lunch for the whole crew, and we sat around and sang and talked the whole day. It was really a wonderful visit. I was so glad that it happened because I had been there before at his house, but I hadn't stayed very long. And so, mm-hmm. And I've seen him on several different occasions and visited with him, and he's still a good friend. He's always been kind and nice to me.
I was wondering, and we were talking before when the Walt Michaels and I were talking about how some of your songs, like Blackwater, the songs you've done about mountaintop removal and the environment and the more spiritual pieces you've written about the earth. And I'm just really wondering how you came to all that and where that kind of passion for the environment, passion for poor people, passion for a more just world came from. I mean, clearly it's deep inside of you.
Well, I guess I came to it because in going home and to visit and in the summertime, or sometimes I'd go and stay get a vacation, and I always go home. I never went anywhere else. I was just so homesick at times for the mountains. I'd always head for there if I could. And so I'd come home, and when you're away, you're more aware of changes when you come back. And I could see how they were changing the mountains and how the some in some places the mountains were kind of disappearing where the big machinery was tearing them apart to get at the coal and so on. And so I wanted to do something about it. I wanted to talk about it, but I don't talk very well. You know, I'd rather sing than talk. And so I thought I could communicate better if I sang. So I did. Black Waters was the first one I finished. And I finished it in a way because of Woody Guthrie, because they were having a memorial concert for him one night, and Pete asked me to come to the village to be part of it. And I finished the song because I'd had it in my mind for a long time. And I sang it that night, and I introduced it as a song about what was going on in the mountains, in the mining field. I said, this is the kind of song that Woody would have written if he had known about this.
Yeah.
So that even in writing songs, or my first song, Woody played a part.
I come from the mountains, Kentucky's my home, where the wild deer and the black bear so lately did roam. By cool rushing waterfalls, the wildflowers dream. And through every green valley there runs a clear stream. Now there seems of destruction on every hand, and there's only black waters run down through my land. Sad scenes of destruction on every hand. Black waters run down through the land.
We'll be right back with Gene Ritchie and our next guest, the one and only Doc Watson. So stay with us.
In my dear old southern home, I was happy as I could be, where the mockingbirds sing at night while they rest in that little old log cabin by the sea. Odelay, odie, odelay, odelay, odie, odelay, odelay, odie, odelay, odie, odelay.
Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show. You can't mistake the sound of that guitar and that voice. It's Doc Watson. Gene, before you go, we're about to interview and talk with Doc Watson, and I think he's online now, and if you all want to say hello for a minute. Doc, are you there?
Hello, I'm here.
And Gene Ritchie's online with us. We've just been talking
to her.
Hello,
Doc.
Hello, Gene.
Been a long time, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. I believe I remember a certain person was standing behind me when we were in New York last year.
Oh, that's right. Well, I did come and say hello and listen to you as avidly as I used to. Yeah, you're still great.
That's for sure.
Well, my old voice is pretty good yet, but I can feel, occasionally I can feel 84 years, but not too bad.
Yeah, we're the same age, aren't we? I said, you and I are the same age.
Yeah.
I'm 84 also.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought we were about the same age.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So, go ahead, Gene. I'm sorry. Please, go ahead.
No, I haven't. I was just going to say we're just a few months apart somehow. I'm in December. I was born in December.
Yeah.
When were you born, Doc?
I was born March 3rd, 1923.
You're older than I am.
Okay.
Doc, do you remember when you two played together back in, what was it, 63, when that became that album?
Yeah, I remember that very well. It was right pretty close to Christmas time, I think. Anyway, it was Gertie's Folk City where it was done.
And my husband, George, who's a photographer, was there that night, all those nights. And he had a Magna Carta. We had just come back, just a few years before that, we had been in England and Scotland and Ireland collecting sources for my family songs. And we had this Magna Carta. And he sat there with the Magna Carta and one microphone. And Doc and me and Roger Sprung was playing banjo and sort of accompanying us. And George had a microphone on a long handle, and he would just sit there, and whenever anyone was doing a solo or something, he'd stick the microphone in front of that person's face. And yeah, then he just moved the microphone around and got all the recordings that way.
It was done very well for the man just having one microphone. Our was pretty good at that, too.
Years later, there was a review of it in one of the big music magazines, and it complimented the sound and said even in those days, there was very good sound. And George laughed and laughed, and they said if they could have just seen me sitting there with one microphone.
It was a real good microphone. That thing was omnidirectional, too. It picked up... it would also pick up good straight on if you wanted to bring up a break that somebody was playing, but it picked up all around, I think, because you could tell by listening. The Smithsonian people still have that CD. They bought the Folkways thing, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And one of my great thrills was in 1972, opening for you and Merle at in the Philly area at the main point.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that. And Merle walked you into the room where I was tuning up my hammer dulcimer, and all of a sudden there was Doc Watson sitting there listening to me play. I'll tell you, I was one nervous young man.
Well, I'm just one of the people like everybody else. I like to play and entertain people, but I never have been one for the pedestal. I can't take it. I'd fall off of it. I'm just me on the stage, informal as I can be.
Well, that's right, and you were wonderful that evening. You asked me to show you around the hammer dulcimer, and it was a great night. Yeah, the pedestal doesn't have any room on it for other people, does it?
Usually it doesn't. The person that's up there and taking great joy in the pedestal, they have a tendency to spread out and take it off.
And one of the other things I love about what you've done, you stayed in North Carolina. You never left North Carolina.
Well, why leave? You ought to travel all over the country anyway if you entertain people. I'm like an old dog. I'm kind of hard to be run off from home.
We always find our way home, don't we?
Merle loved home as good as I did. He traveled a lot, and he and I saw a little bit of the world besides the United States, but we never forgot where home was.
Doc, what was the song that the instrumental that Merle wrote? I think he wrote it in Greenwich Village. It was sort
Southbound.
Of Southbound, right.
Yeah. Oh, he got out one day and walked about, I don't think he was going over 2 hours, and he came back, and when he sat down, he said, "Whew, I've walked till I've blistered my feet." That was one of the lines in his song, you know.
Right, right, yeah. Yeah, that New York City can seem awful lonesome.
You talk about homesick days. When I was working in there and didn't have a good start in the music, I spent many a day there with nothing to do, sitting up on a little deck lock that was all fenced in and above Ralph Rensselaer's fifth-floor apartment. You could go up there, and the brick wall around that roof, the edge of that roof, was about shoulder high with a capstone. And he had a deck chair or two up there, and most of the time when I was in New York, and it would be a sunny day if it was rainy or any snow coming. I didn't go up there, but at least I had a way of getting away from a lot of the city noise, and I could think. And think about the music and songs, and then most of the time think about Rosalie and the children before Merle started with me.
Mm.
There was an escape from it, in a sense. But I was a homeboy and a really homesick most of the time when I'd be away from home for a long time. I'd work a week or 2 weeks at a time in New York sometimes.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Both you and Gene have talked about being homesick. And I think for folks who haven't lived in the mountains, I spent some time in McDowell County, West Virginia, as a young man. And I still dream about it. Those mountains are they're very nurturing and friendly. And it's hard to imagine for someone who hasn't been there just how wonderful they are.
Well, when you grow up in the country, it never leaves you. It's a memory, like it's kind of like a book. When you start thinking back, my short-term memory is not what it used to be, and I've always had a one-track mind, but the memory of my childhood, what I mean by a one-track mind, most people misunderstand that maybe, but a one-track mind is if you have something on your mind and somebody brings up something that's really important, that one will slide off and you can't pick it up for maybe till the next day. You've got a one-track mind. You replace whatever was on your mind, and then it don't come back to you.
Right. Right.
I always tell people I'm like a ship with a long anchor. And that anchor is in the mountains, and I love coming back to it.
Me too. The mountains are... Well, Rosalie and I live out in the country. I wouldn't live any other place. I was listening to the echo against a little woodland that's close to our house here this morning when I got up and opened up the blind and raised up the window. She said, raise the window. And I could hear the echo, and it was like almost like a wind. The whole along the Dock and Merle Watson Highway stretch here is a big four-lane now, and you could hear that echo, and it didn't sound like traffic. It was kind of like almost like a wind that had a tone to it.
Mm.
And I told her, I said, honey, I could sleep to that kind of traffic noise, but not if I lived right by the highway.
I'm going away for to leave you, love. I'm going away for a while. But I'll return. Storms are on the ocean, the heavens may cease to be, this world may lose its motion, love, if I prove false to thee. Now who will shoot?
Tell the story about what you did one time. I asked you to. I used to play a song, "Pretty Fair Miss Working Garden," and one night I was listening to how beautifully Doc played everything, and my guitar went oompa oompa oompa. That was about all I could do. So I said, ask him one night to play for me on that song, and he said I'd be delighted. So he took it and took the guitar, and when I started to sing, he played oompa, 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 you know. And I said to him afterwards, why did you play the same thing that I did? Why didn't you play something fancy?
I wanted the people.
And he said that's all that song needs.
It's all it needed while you sang. I didn't need to cover you up with fills and notes.
I really learned something that night. That it's all right to be simple.
Well, a simple song or a song that's really involved, you know. If a person's singing, the audience needs to focus on your singing and not my guitar playing. And I wanted to play chords that that kind of fit what you did as in the song, with the song, rather.
Yeah.
And no more than that. That was, I've always been that way about
yeah.
I've heard people play over other people's singing, Gene, and to me that bothered me. If you play too much behind a person's vocal, it interferes with it.
Mm. Well, it's, so many of my songs are made to be sung unaccompanied, I guess.
And well, or at least if there's chords, they should be quietly played. Just for the sake of timing and whatever, you know.
Yeah. Well, it was always a pleasure to be on the same page with you, Doc.
You know, Doc and Gene, I took some of my students to Bull Creek, West Virginia, and I ran into a fellow I hadn't seen since 1972. His name was Zink Bailey, and he's a fine mandolin player and guitar player.
Yeah.
And we started, I hadn't seen him for years, and I had brought a guitar, and we just sat down and played. And my students were amazed that people could do that without rehearsing or, you know, talking about it first. And I didn't think anything about it because that's the way this music happens.
That's called playing by ear.
Yeah.
I learned, all the music I learned was by ear. The only music thing I related to music that I studied actually by ear was piano tuning. I sat in a window. I didn't take the class. I sat in a basement window that was about, the windowsill was about 2 feet off the ground, and I sat on that and heard Mr. Cox, the teacher, the tuning teacher, teach piano. He was blind, too, and he taught piano tuning, and I learned everything about it. He described the hammer that was, had a wrench on the other side that you turn the pins with. I learned about that, and I learned about tempered tuning so that the piano plays true chords all over the scale in any key, all that. And then I learned about how to put strings on the thing, all of that. I must have heard him teach, I guess, 100 classes.
Mm-hmm.
And I might as well have taken the class. I never was interested in trying to repair the action on the thing. Some of the boys were really good at it. I could have been, but I didn't do that. And then I tuned pianos a bunch in the 50s. When I was playing electric guitar with a local dance band.
What kind of guitar were you playing, Doc?
Les Paul.
Les Paul. Oh, man.
Yeah. My grandson Richard still has it. Merle had it while he was here, and it was passed on to Richard. Oh. He has it. He put it back in playing shape.
Oh, that's
I wore the fretboard out, board out on the thing. I got in 10 years, nearly 10 years worth of invaluable practice.
Wow.
I'll use the flat pick most of the time. There was no fiddle player for the square dances, but I could play fiddle tunes beautifully and quiet, about as loud as a fiddle. I never banged on it like some of the rockers do, you know. I didn't do that.
Well, it's amazing to hear that both of you talk about how music just came naturally to
everything
you all.
I learned on the guitar, I learned by ear. Nobody taught me anything except one fella I went to school with, and he showed me my first few chords of Paul Montgomery. He's gone now. He's about my age, and he was a fine musician in his own right and a wonderful jazz piano player. But on the other hand, he could turn around and play all that good country stuff. Fiddle tunes, anything you name it, he could play it on the piano. You meet a lot of good people in this whole world as you come along through it.
Yeah. I understand you listened a lot to Sam and Kirk McGee. Did you learn some guitar licks?
Yeah,
from...
any guitar player that had good licks, I was apt to pick up on them.
Yeah.
But I played my own style. It just naturally... How did you invent your own style? How, you know, a lot of the young folks ask me. I didn't. It just happened. And it does.
Right.
It's just something you feel, and it comes out.
Yeah.
It becomes
a true talented person... with God-given talent, you'll have your own style once you learn to play it well, you know.
Yeah, and style can't be taught, can it? It's just either...
There is very few people that can mimic people's other people's styles, but there's occasionally there's someone that can do it. Most people stick to their own style. I used to mimic Smitty Smith, that was an electric guitar player with Ernest Tubb. He played some jazz licks and country music that I just had to absorb.
Gene Ritchie and Doc Watson, thank you both so much. And
thank you.
Okay.
All right.
Talk to you
both.
Good talk to both of you. Thank you so much. Welcome. I'm Mark Steiner. Ted Gioia is our guest right now, and he is a noted musician, an award-winning author. He created Jazz.com back in December of 2007, written books like The History of Jazz, West Coast Jazz, The Imperfect Art, Reflections on Jazz and Modern Culture, Work Songs and Healing Songs. His work that we're talking about today is called Delta Blues, The Life and Times of the Mississippi Masters Who Revolutionized American Music. And this is a very different exploration for you. Maybe talk about that journey. What led you to make this switch into blues, because you're not known as a blues man?
You know, my background is in jazz, almost a universe away from the blues. And if you had talked to me when I was 20 years old, you would have found that I looked down on the blues, like many jazz musicians. But it's interesting, as I got older, you know, the music seemed to get more complex and more mysterious. And the blues music I thought I understood when I was 20, you know, when I got into my 30s and turned 40, all of a sudden this music seemed absolutely fascinating. And over the last several years, I've devoted myself to a study of blues, and not just blues, other types of traditional music. So really, you're right. It's been a big turnabout for me from the world of jazz to the world of blues.
I think that you touched on something that a lot of people think and that you kind of explore in your own way in this book, which is, as you unpeel back the layers, talk a bit about that complexity that you discovered in the blues for yourself and what the kind of hidden texture of the blues underneath.
When I learned the music as a young man, I learned the blues as having a 12-bar form. There were certain chord progressions, and it was a formula that you followed, and a fairly simple formula. What I realized as I immersed myself more into the blues masters was how seldom they actually followed this formula. If I listened to the music of Son House or John Lee Hooker or Charlie Patton or many of the traditional players, their music rarely added up to 12 bars. They rarely followed these chord patterns, and they were doing something else. And it was trying to figure out, well, what is this something else? That proved to be very provocative. You know, I even got to the point of working with this college professor who's got this equipment that allows him to do microrhythmic analysis of music. He'll put a recording on and see where you actually place the beat. And we were working trying to figure out what the heck is John Lee Hooker doing when he's playing the guitar? Because, you know, it sounds so natural and so simple, but when you try to replicate it, you know, no one can.
And this music, I mean, there have been a lot of arguments about the roots of blues, and you have taken a very specific look at the Delta, a very profound place when it comes to the history of America, to civil rights movement, to the origins of our blues music. I mean, so let's talk about why you honed in on the Delta and what the Delta has given us.
If you look for the origins of the blues, you can actually find some hints and traces very early on in every former slave state. And so I can't claim that Mississippi is the birthplace of the blues, although some people do claim that. But I think if you listen to the music, you find that the blues there existed with a certain intensity of expression and intensity of feeling that you didn't find elsewhere. It's almost amazing that this music got recorded at all, because it really doesn't seem commercial by even the farthest leap of the imagination. And then the great irony of it is this music eventually became very commercial. Virtually all of later rock music and so much of later popular music comes out of this tradition. And that process I found very fascinating. And really the epicenter of that is the Mississippi Delta. Let me give you just a couple anecdotes or examples. I don't think it's coincidental that when Elvis Presley had his first single, he recorded the song of a Delta blues musician. And then let me fast forward a few years later, 1961, there's this great moment. It takes place on a train, and this is over in England. We're across the Atlantic now. And Mick Jagger and Keith Richards run into each other, and they sort of catch up on this train, and Keith Richards is most amazed by the fact that Mick Jagger has these Muddy Waters records with him. And Keith had never heard of Muddy Waters, and he said they spent the rest of that day listening to this music over and over again in rapt admiration. So once again, a Delta blues musician. Or when the Beatles first came over to the United States, they gave a press conference. People asked them, well, what American music do you admire? And they mentioned Muddy Waters. And the irony here is that the journalists think that they're talking about a place on the map. They don't realize that Muddy Waters is the name of a person.
Uh-huh.
But whether you go through that or through Clapton or the Animals or Eric Burdon or whatever, time and time again, you have these later musicians going back into the heart of the Delta blues and finding inspiration there.
I think that's one of the most important points of all this in some ways, because I think that's the transformative power of the Delta blues on the musical culture of the entire planet. I mean, it's amazing.
Well, that's right. And here's the fascinating issue, if you ask me. As I note, the blues really is music of people torn from their culture, torn from their community, torn from their history, forced to relocate, and they sing of their loneliness and alienation. And then the question is, why would that music appeal to white Americans and the mainstream power structure of the country? But I think we find something quite profound here, because during the course of the 20th century, almost everyone was now being torn from their roots and their traditions. And people were moving from the small town into the urban area. People were being dislocated from their families. Traditions were being torn apart. And to some extent, everybody now was experiencing the same thing that the black population had. Now, not as intense and not with such oppression, but for this reason, this music that really had been part of an oppressed minority now could be relevant to the majority. It's an amazing transformation, almost unlike anything you see in popular music. But I believe that what you find here is the blues music predicted the future of everybody. It may have talked about the past of African Americans, but it also predicted the way the world was going to develop for all of us.
You tackle one of the thorny subjects here, and I really want to let people hear your take on it. And that's the question of Alan Lomax, of course, who is the great folklorist and chronicler and collector of sounds of American music, roots music throughout Appalachia and the South, to bring these sounds out, and people accusing Alan Lomax of taking credit for this, leaving out the work of all the black folklorists out of Fisk University and places like that. And you have a very specific take on this.
Alan Lomax was the single most ardent preserver and discoverer of traditional American music. But Lomax was also a very controversial figure. People have accused him of all sorts of things, of, you know, copyright violations, or of demeaning the musicians he discovered, or of stealing the work of people that cooperated with him. But really, this is where I come down. Alan Lomax was not a saint. And you can criticize him for many of the things he did, but categorically, I do not believe he stole research materials from John Work and the people at Fisk University. I don't believe that can be substantiated or proven. In fact, all the evidence suggests otherwise. You know, the case made against him is that John Work's contribution was hidden and obscured by Lomax. But if you look at Lomax's book on the Delta, John Work is the first person he thanks in the acknowledgments. If you look at the recordings that came out, John Work is mentioned extensively there. People that met with Lomax said that Lomax was quick to try to share with them John Work's books and writings, and was very open about what Work had done. A big thing was made about Lomax having these things that had been written by John Work and hiding them in his own personal files. But in fact, this copy in Lomax's files turned out to be a mimeograph. So anyone saying that Lomax was trying to keep the originals from view, I just don't see you can make a case for that. Now, that said, you know, Lomax did some things that I don't completely agree with, but my bottom line is this man did so much for American music, so much for preserving American music. I tend to view him positively, and I tend to turn a blind eye towards his failings, and I really think the critiques against him have gone too far. But this is a controversial area, and the controversies over Alan Lomax, I am sure, will continue to bristle back and forth for decades to come.
I want to thank you, Ted Gioia, for joining us. The book Delta Blues, The Life and Times of the Mississippi Masters Who Revolutionized American Music. That's G-I-O-I-A, Ted Gioia. And Ted, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's been a great pleasure talking.
It's been a pleasure here as well. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. Our editor is Andrew Epic. We're engineered at WEAA by Zachary Coleman. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, or podcast any of our past shows, or hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.